It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. The sports world lost a legend today. Former Penn State football coach Joe Paterno died this morning at a hospital in State College, Pennsylvania. Paterno coached the university's football team for 61 years. He was forced out in November after the child sex abuse scandal that's badly damaged the school's program. Outside Penn State's football stadium today, mourners just wanted to remember the man they called Joe Pa. Here's NPR's Jeff Brady.
All day, cars drove slowly past a bronze statue of Joe Paterno. Many stopped and quietly walked up to the statue to pay respects. Among them, 1991 Penn State graduate Kristen Vanderbush. Shivering and with tears running down her face, she read a quote by Paterno that's on the wall behind the statue.
They asked me what I'd like written about me when I'm gone. I hope they write, "I made Penn State a better place." Not that I was just a good football coach. And that's exactly what he did. And to be able to have a statement like that and to fulfill it, that's quite a legacy.
Vanderbush left a handwritten note for Paterno. Nearby, third-generation Penn State graduate Dave Young brought his 6-year-old son. On the growing display of hats, flags, flowers, and candles, they laid a pair of blue gloves. Young says he wore them to Paterno's final home game against Illinois in October.
I had a random pair of Penn State gloves that day that I found in my drawer. They were pretty terrible gloves. I was freezing, but it was a memory from that day. It was snowy. It was awful.
Young says he fondly remembers Saturdays with his dad watching Joe Paterno coach football games. The recent scandal added a few bad memories. Still, Young hopes the focus will turn to Paterno's effort to boost the role of academics in college sports.
I was in many classes with football players, and they would sit in the front row of every class. They would answer questions. Hands were up. They were engaged. And I think that is Joe Paterno's mentality, is you're not here for football. Is a benefit of coming to school here. It's not what you're here for. You're here to become a more educated person, a better person in the long run.
A final confirmation of Paterno's educational legacy came in December. The New America Foundation ranked Penn State's football team first in academics among the top 25 teams in the country. As a child sex abuse scandal unfolded at Penn State in November, Paterno was mostly silent. Just after he was fired, his family announced he was being treated for lung cancer. Last week, Paterno talked with the Washington Post, which released scratchy recordings of those conversations today. Here, Paterno talks about his firing and lung cancer diagnosis.
Hey, the good Lord's got a reason. You know, I'm not as concerned about me. I mean, what's happened to me has been great. I've got 5 great kids, 17 great grandchildren.
That outlook on life is one reason people like Penn State senior Zachary Robinson came out to the Joe Paterno statue today.
There's lots of people gathered here, taking pictures, leaving candles and flowers and signs for Joe Pa. Just trying to show their love for him.
The hospital where Joe Paterno was being treated says he died just before 9:30 this morning. Doctors say the cause was lung cancer. He was 85 years old. Jeff Brady, NPR News, State College, Pennsylvania.
They say you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but the big question is, can you teach an old guitarist new licks? How about an old non-guitarist? Not even a musician. Well, Gary Marcus isn't that old. He's actually in his early 40s, and he's a professor of psychology at NYU and an expert on cognitive development. Marcus decided to pick up the guitar to study the musical learning process, using himself as a guinea pig. His new book is called Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. Gary Marcus joins us from our New York bureau. Welcome to the program, Gary.
Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, so before we begin our conversation, I want to play a little something for you. Take a listen to this. Sound familiar?
Painfully so.
Okay, explain why. Tell us about this song.
Well, this whole book, in a way, got started with me playing a video game called Guitar Hero, which I had purchased in a vague hope of becoming musical, and then discovered I couldn't play it because I had to play this song. All you have to do is press little colored buttons
to match
the colored dots on the screen. And eventually I got it, and I actually made it through the song. So when I had that positive experience of playing the video game and feeling like maybe this is not completely out of my reach, plus I had a little bit of free time because I was actually on sabbatical, I was like, this is the moment. I'm really going to try now. I'm really going to commit myself. And I'd also read the literature on critical periods. That's the idea that if you don't learn something early in life, you'll never be able to master it. And I'd studied language acquisition in graduate school, and we used to believe that that was the case, that if you didn't learn by the time you were 16, you'd never become fluent.
Yeah, we all kind of live with that pressure. You have to learn it when you're a little kid. Otherwise, you can't learn French when you're an adult.
So what we know now is that some adults actually do become fluent, and that although it's definitely easier to learn some things when you're a kid, it's not the case that you just absolutely lose the ability later in life. There's more of a gradual decline. It is still possible.
So how important is some kind of innate musicality to learning later in life?
I think that innate musicality is important, but it's not absolutely necessary. I guess my own case proves that. So I wouldn't say I had any innate musicality. But because I'm an intelligent adult, I was able to learn a lot of things about how music works that maybe wouldn't be as accessible to a child, to read about music theory, for example, and to apply the analytic skills that I have and sort of take a different route than a child might take.
Hmm. So we want to trace your particular musical route a little bit. You very graciously and, I should add, courageously sent us one of your very early practice sessions when you had just picked up the guitar.
I feel a painful trip down memory lane coming.
It sounds on this track like you're kind of improvising a little bit with a backup track. If you don't mind, let's hear a little bit of it now. Take a listen.
Backing track sounds nice.
It's all about putting it out there, giving it a try. I mean, tell us what was going through your mind. What was the most difficult thing about playing the guitar, improvising at that stage of your learning process?
I think everything was hard. I would say that the first challenging thing for anybody learning the guitar is just learning the fretboard, where the notes are. So if you look at a piano, the notes are laid out in a very systematic way. You can always very easily find the C in whichever octave you're in. You can find the D, you know, the next note over, skipping the black note. It's very systematic. On a guitar, there's nothing that kind of highlights, first of all, what the natural notes are, the Cs, the Ds, as opposed to the C sharps and the D sharps. And then every string sets things up differently. And we have the kind of memory that makes similar things hard to remember. So like if you park in the same lot every day, your memories of that blur together. And at the end of the day, you can't remember exactly where you parked because you're confused with where you parked on other days. So when I was doing that improvisation or trying to do that improvisation, part of what I was trying to do was just find the notes in the scale. But even knowing where those are takes work.
There's something else we'd like to play for you, Gary. Let's take a listen to this. Wow, that bass line. Listen to that.
That was me.
That is you playing bass guitar in a group called Rush Hour. This is a band that came together at a band camp full of 11-year-olds, right?
That's right. The camp's called Day Jams. It's a national organization. And I went to my hometown in Baltimore. I spent a week there. And what you do with that camp is you make your own song. You arrive on Monday. And by Friday, you're playing on stage in front of a live audience, which includes all the kids' parents, and in my case, it included mine. So we put together that song.
What did you discover when you were there about the differences in the way that you were learning and the way that these kids were learning?
Well, I think that kids have a lot more patience to do the same thing over and over again until they get it right. And I think adults often push themselves to get the whole song on the first day. Adults, you know, they've heard the recordings many times, and they don't cut themselves the slack to take things incrementally. And so I think there's a difference in strategy. I think that kids probably have a little bit better ear. So if you want to learn perfect pitch, you have to learn that early in life. On the other hand, adults understand things like composition. So I actually played a big role in actually putting the song together.
I have to tell you that I have a guitar that I've owned since I was about 20 years old, 19 maybe. And I was so intent on learning the guitar for like 6 months. And then the guitar went into the closet and I've been schlepping that thing around with me wherever I move. And it just sits in the corner and taunts me. And I've been intimidated to pick it up. In all of your learning about how to learn a musical instrument later in life, what advice can you give to someone like me or others out there who have other musical instruments sitting in their corners taunting them?
I think the first thing is to give yourself slack and don't expect to learn it overnight. So learning an instrument for most people is probably a project of several years. The only way to do the brain rewiring that you need is to practice. There are ways of being a bit more efficient about your practice. So another tip I would say is target your weaknesses. A lot of people just do what they're good at. They don't focus on what they're bad at. In my case, I really had to focus on the rhythm. If I had just done what I was good at, I would still sound terrible. Now I don't quite sound terrible. And that's because I focus so much on that. So don't expect overnight success. Try to enjoy each incremental bit of progress that you make.
Gary Marcus is the author of Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. We're going to play out with a little bit of your soloing on something called Bah Humbug. Gary, thanks so much. I expect to talk with you in a few years to check in on how your jam skills have developed.
Thank you very much.
That brings us to our next story, the potential for governments, from dictatorships to democracies, to exploit technology, to spy on their own citizens. John Villasenor is a fellow at the Brookings Institution, and he's written a paper on how governments may soon be able to record much of what is said or done within their borders. Every phone conversation, electronic message, Facebook post, tweet, and video from every street corner, and then store that information indefinitely. John joins us now from member station KQED in San Francisco to talk more about this phenomenon. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So this is a disturbing idea that a government, particularly an authoritarian government, could access so much information about a person. And you say this has to do with the cost of storing this kind of information. It's getting cheaper?
Yeah. So storage costs, as many people know, have been dropping for quite some time. But what is perhaps less widely appreciated is how fast they've been dropping and how much they've dropped. It is now, for example, possible to store everything that someone says on a telephone for a year for about 17 cents. So as these storage costs plummet, it all of a sudden becomes possible to actually archive it all. And that's what's changing. We're crossing these thresholds now and in the coming couple of years.
Give us some real-world examples. How could this play out in a country like Syria?
Well, in countries like Syria, there's no reason to expect that governments won't take advantage of every possible technological tool at their disposal to monitor their citizenry. Smartphones and the apps that run on smartphones very often track location, and in an authoritarian country, governments could presumably get access to that information. About $50 worth of storage could store the information identifying the location of each of 1 million people to within 15 feet at 5-minute intervals, 24 hours a day for a full year. And so if you took a country like 15 million people, then that means it would cost about only $750 to store all of their movements for a year.
Wow.
License plate cameras. These are basically roadside cameras, or in some cases they're mounted inside police cars that automatically take a picture or take an image of the license plate of every vehicle that passes in the field of view of the camera, and they store those. They raise very significant privacy concerns, but it should also be said that they have been responsible for solving some very serious crimes as well. And they are proliferating all over the world. The United Kingdom has a very large network. They're being used in Toronto. New York has a network. And they build these enormous databases. And so you can expect, in fact, that when you go out in your car to run an errand, that you are tracked, or will be soon in the next couple of years, tracked by any number of license plate cameras. And that will go into some big database someday, and somebody can look at it if they want.
John Villasenor is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. We caught up with him from member station KQED in San Francisco. John, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. It is that time of year again when the divas and darlings of the indie film scene descend on the snow-covered mountain town of Park City, Utah for the Sundance Film Festival. The established industry types are all there to sample the latest indie film offerings. And up-and-coming directors are there hoping for the distribution deal of a lifetime. There are always new faces at Sundance, but this year, there's a familiar director making the rounds.
I work. Slavery days are over. My name ain't Kunta Kinte.
That's Mookie, the main character of Spike Lee's much-loved film Do the Right Thing. Mookie's back in a new Spike Lee film. And to tell us more about it, we've got Stacey Wilson with us. She writes for The Hollywood Reporter, and she joins us now from member station KPCW in Park City. Thanks for being with us, Stacey.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Mookie, he's coming back, being reprised in another Spike Lee movie. It's called Red Hook Summer, another film about summertime in Brooklyn. What can you tell us about this?
Well, I sat down with Spike a couple weeks ago, and when he made a rare trip to L.A., as you know, he prefers to stay in his native New York habitat. The film is definitely a return to his kind of grit filmmaking style, very low budget. I estimated it to be between about $600,000 and $900,000, so very low budget, you know, compared to some of his more recent films.
Is there any buzz around this film besides the fact that Mookie is showing up again?
The film is kind of harkens back to Do the Right Thing. It takes place during a summer in Brooklyn. A young boy from Atlanta spends a summer with a grandfather he's never met, who's a preacher. And it was actually co-written by James McBride, who's an author who's written a number of novels, including The Color of Water. And he and Spike wrote Miracle at St. Anna a few years ago together, which was about soldiers in World War II.
Okay, so a veteran filmmaker reinventing himself yet again.
Another
big name at the festival, director Peter Jackson. But he's at Sundance not as a director of a big-budget special effects kind of movie. He's there as a producer. He's showing this documentary called West of Memphis. It's about this case that became very controversial, the West Memphis Three. Remind us what that case was about.
In the early 90s, there were three eight-year-old boys who were found murdered. And West Memphis is actually in Arkansas. And then they quickly arrested three teenage boys who were imprisoned and then put through a trial and were sentenced to life in prison. And a lot of people felt that very early on that the case was not handled properly, that there was not sufficient evidence to actually have them in prison. So the film, like the HBO series that also featured this case, Paradise Lost, the film really gets into the nuts and bolts of how fraught with problems this case was, how DNA evidence actually exonerates the men, or a lot of people feel it exonerates the men from having killed these young boys because they had no motive. A lot of people said it just never added up for a lot of folks.
So what does Peter Jackson's film bring to this case that's different?
Most importantly, what the film features is new evidence. As recently as this month, one of the men, Damien Eccles, who has been released, all three men are now released, but they have not been exonerated. That's sort of the confusing part of it. But they were all there at the screening with Peter Jackson, with Fran Walsh, with the director, and it was very emotional for everyone.
And there's an interesting connection here. Joe Berlinger, who was actually the director on that Paradise Lost series, he's at the festival with something completely different. He's got his own documentary out on Paul Simon and the 25th anniversary of the making of Graceland.
Yes, exactly. Under African Skies, and I have not had a chance to see the film as yet, but it's very special. I think Graceland is a very sort of benchmark record for a lot of people I know. It was very meaningful to me when I was younger. And interestingly enough, Neil Young is also the subject of a documentary this year directed by Jonathan Demme. So it'll be fascinating to see what those films shed light on.
And women filmmakers are making a good showing this year?
They are. I it's sort of disheartening whenever we bring up that topic, as it's sort of, you know, still kind of a novelty, which obviously there are so many women making films. But what's fun is that a lot of the films are getting a little bit more lighthearted. John Cooper, the director of the festival, stated the other day, he said, you know, it's so amazing. There are so many comedies this year, which, you know, a lot of people who've gone to Sundance, you feel things are very serious here a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Independent filmmakers tend to be serious folks telling serious stories. But there are a couple very fun, lighthearted films, two wedding-themed films, interestingly. Both were not sort of on the heels of Bridesmaids, but they were sort of in production when Bridesmaids became a hit. And they're called Bachelorette and Save the Date. So I think those will be fun. They have a kind of marquee stars, Kirsten Dunst and Isla Fisher. And then we also have another comedy actually directed by two men, Tim Heidegger and Eric Wareheim. Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie, sort of cult TV favorites. They always do very absurd, fun stuff. That premiered at the festival as well. I've seen the film. It's really fun. Will Forte is in the film, and Will Ferrell produced it with Funny or Die. So I think we're seeing comedy is becoming more and more of a priority because there's no reason these movies can't be fun.
Stacey Wilson of The Hollywood Reporter. The Sundance Film Festival runs until January 29th. Stacey, thanks so much.
Thank you.